Welcome back to The Bookshelf. I'm Ben Reed. In tonight's episode, Jonathan's daughter Anya will start her first day of school in Scotland. This is The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson.
This morning, Amy, Anya, and I walked up to the Crail Primary School, an old stone building with high windows and a skirt of tarmac painted for hopscotch and foursquare. We were going so Anya could meet the head teacher, Mrs. McMillan, before the start of fall term next week. This move to Scotland has shaken Anya's usually independent spirit some and brought on a bit of her own anxiety. As we sat across from Mrs. McMillan in the teacher's lounge to ask about school supplies and school uniform specifications, Anya crossed her fingers, ring over pinky, pointer over middle, on both hands. We learned Anya's class will be a blended room of primary 4 and primary 5, the equivalent of 3rd and 4th grades in the U.S., and her teacher's name is Mrs. Lang. Anya began playing with the Velcro clasp on her raincoat sleeve and kept her eyes down. But when the delicately featured, gray-bobbed Mrs. McMillan started to go over the weekly schedule and said with gentle enthusiasm that Anya's class would have Mrs. Taylor on Mondays for 50 minutes of drama, Anya's head and eyes rose, and she couldn't suppress a smile when she said, "Drama? We will?" She looked at her mom and at me, then back at Mrs. McMillan, right in the eyes. "We don't have drama classes at my school in America." Anya's out on the beach now, building sandcastles with Sam from next door. Amy was just here in the bedroom where I'm writing beside the open window. She brought me a smoothie made with berries from the village greengrocer and said, "I'm so relieved. I'm actually excited for Anya about school." "Yeah," I said. "Mrs. McMillan was great." "And Anya's excited." "Anya's excited." I try to remind myself periodically that Anya is 8 years old. To her, the prospect of 1 year living abroad must seem like 5 years to me at 40. For weeks when we'd talked about Scotland, she'd asked fretfully, "But it's only maybe, right?" And we'd answer, "Yes, but it's probably." When we heard my sabbatical was approved, she was furious. I had anticipated a rough go of it when we sat down at the dinner table and I told her I'd gotten the letter and it was official. What we got was genuine rage. Her first and so far only tantrum. She even mocked us through her tears. "Oh, no, can't go for 2 weeks like everybody else. No, have to go for a year." She knows us. But since we've arrived, I've been deeply proud of her. We weren't done unpacking before she was out on the rock reef, looking in the tide pools and picking up hermit crabs. She calls her bedroom in the cottage my bedroom. A few days ago, she drew our cottage and garden on a restaurant napkin, pinned in the steep steps down to the harbor, and looped dozens of circles for the seawall stones on top of which she drew a seagull. School, though, even a small village school, is another matter. All those kids she'll have no choice about getting to know. Their accents and that of her teacher that she'll have to decipher. The new curriculum. It occurs to me that I, who will be going for walks and writing before this window of mine, am requiring her to make a much greater adjustment than I'll be making myself. The cottage next door is empty again. Jeff Rawl has been cast in a play at the National Theater, and he and his family have left for London. So Sam, Anya's one friend in Scotland, is gone. No more tide pooling together with nets and bright buckets out on the seaweed-strewn rocks. And now she has to start school, to be the new kid. Amy and I walked up with her through the village, past rows of attached cottages, the bookshop, the fish and chip restaurant, the bakery, the butchers, and the greengrocers, on her way to her first day. In her white and navy uniform with the gold Crail Primary crab insignia, she was the picture of confidence. The day before, we'd visited her classroom and met her teacher, Mrs. Lang, a tall woman with reddish-blonde curls surrounding her big glasses and kindly smile. From her calm possession of the room one day before it filled with children, I guessed her to have 20 years of teaching behind her. Doubtless, Mrs. Lang read Amy and me immediately as parents way out of their element, nervous over their only child starting a new school in a new country. But like a pro, she spoke mostly to Anya, welcoming her, asking her what she was enjoying about Scotland. rock pooling, and showing her around the classroom. Everything from books to bins of Legos and markers was waiting on carts. Trolleys, Mrs. Lang called them in her thick Scottish accent, because, as she explained, she wanted the children to choose where things went. It'll be their classroom that way. True empathy, I thought. A teacher with the ability to see the world through her students' eyes. If you want, why don't you come 5 minutes early, Anya, before we let in all the others? That way you won't have to make an entrance. You'll already be here. Anya tilted her head and looked off, out of the corners of her eye, as she often does when she's mulling over her thoughts. Okay. And your parents can stay, as long as you like. So, as we approach the school and the little crowd of parents around the cluster of their children in navy and white waiting for the first bell of the year, I was already grateful to Mrs. Lang for some of the confidence in Anya's stride. But some of that confidence, I knew, was all her own, her deep openness to the world showing through. She permitted us to kiss her in the narrow alley, the wind, as they call such passages here, between the high street and the school. At the school gate, though, she gently told us she wouldn't need us to stay in the classroom. We could come in, but just until the day began. Mrs. Lang greeted us in her empty classroom with a big smile and, a bit harried though she was, stopped herself and asked Anya how she was doing. Great, Anya said. And sure enough, when the bell rang and the kids came streaming in, she sent us on our way with an instructive bye-bye. Do you want us to come at lunch? Amy asked. Or, I chimed in, you're allowed to come home for lunch if you want. Her classmates were hanging up their coats. They were unzipping their backpacks and flooding in around us. No, thank you. Bye-bye, she reiterated, this time with a bit more insistence. So her mom and I waded through the uniformed children and out the door. How would it go? Amy and I went back to the cottage, and while we wondered, we cleaned. Spit spot, my mom used to say, quoting her beloved Mary Poppins. No matter what else you can't control, you can make a neat, clean house for a child to come home to. But we couldn't keep ourselves away from the school, despite telling Anya we would. Honestly, we don't always hover so. This may only be Scotland, not some chaotic developing nation, but it was still a foreign country we were sending our girl out into. Sending her out, in fact, far more than we'd be putting ourselves out into it on a daily basis. We came up with an excuse to see her at the lunch break. Maybe we had been supposed to send something for her morning snack. Maybe for the snack she'd had to eat part of the lunch we sent. We should bring her some more cheese and crackers, we told ourselves, and a couple of those cookies, digestives, that she's discovered here. When she spotted us in the hall on her way to the cafeteria, she gave us a look of mild reproach, took the little plastic baggies we brought her with a thanks, and was off before we could see even if she'd found a buddy to sit with. Where does such self-confidence come from? How do we learn to be open to the world, especially when we are small and new to it? And how do we keep that openness, that sense that we belong in our lives, that we are home with ourselves? It's a question for my mother, of course. Amy and I must be doing plenty right with Anya. I have no doubt my mother's answer would include that. We tell our daughter that she's loved, that she's capable. We delight in her interests and activities, but we also give her time to discover herself alone and with friends. We're empathic with her. That's what my mother would boil it down to. We can imagine the world through the child's eyes, that ability I was so pleased to recognize right away in Mrs. Lang. And, my mother would say, we're responsible to Anya. My mother's parents drank themselves to death, leaving her an orphan at 17. That is not to say they didn't tell my mother she was loved and capable. No doubt they delighted in her interests and activities, sometimes anyway. I don't know how much empathy they were capable of, though I've no reason to suppose they lacked the capacity to imagine at least a glimpse of the world through my mother's eyes. But they drank. They drank so much they developed liver failure within months of each other and died in their young 40s. They had jobs. He was a glass crafter and set carpenter for Warner Brothers. She drove a delivery truck out of Los Angeles into what were then orange groves and farm fields, deserts, and little towns. They bought a house in Santa Monica and lived there with my mother, her older brother Ron, her younger sister Charlene, and the children's grandmother. They bought the kids a dog, Snuffy, a golden cocker spaniel, with long, floppy ears and big feet, my mom would recall with a smile. They took the kids on vacation to Catalina and Santa Cruz. Ultimately, though, my mother's parents surrendered their responsibility for my mother and her brother and sister. Slowly at first, I'd guess. But the kind of drinking it took to destroy their livers so young must have soon been horrific. For one person to spiral into alcoholic liver failure that young would have been unusual enough, but for them both to do so, and within months of each other, leaving their three children forever orphaned? There can be no doubt about how lost Ian, whom everyone called Mac, and Florence were. How lost and ultimately incapable of that greatest of responsibilities, parenthood. I wasn't there. What I have is my mom telling me about a glass broken on the bridge of her nose, about losing furniture, the house, about moving into a little apartment with her father who tried to dry out after watching his still young wife die in the hospital, and how it was too late. I have my mother, with her huge empathy for me, nonetheless telling me when I was an adolescent that she could never, never come get me from jail drunk, could never rescue me from the bottle if that's what I chose. I have the memory of the fear creeping up in me, fear at the thought of what she must have survived to bring so profoundly uncharacteristic an injunction against helping me ever. What a vortex her parents' drinking must have been. I have a picture of my mother at about Anya's age, a portrait. Her smile is a little girl's genuine smile. Her red hair has been beautifully curled into ringlets. Someone has chosen a dark green velvet dress to bring out the light emerald of her eyes. Someone has given her a gold cross necklace. Had the vortex by then begun its deep, black turning beneath her? At some point, her parents must have become like children themselves. Almost four decades after they were dead, my mother woke swimming in narcotics and pain from the surgery to amputate her foot. She called her sister and brother to her side and said, "I saw them. I saw Mom and Dad." So where on earth did my mother's self-confidence come from? How could she possibly have grown into an adult so open to the world, so thoroughly the companion of sunshine and seagulls and little flower shoots rising from the soil and of her own children? How did she learn to be completely at home in her life? There are answers I suppose I'll never know, but some I do. The Catholic Church, for one, with its orderly little school, I imagine must have been a lot like Crail Primary. A concrete and asphalt schoolyard around an old stone building, and children in neat, clean uniforms, everyone belonging. The same Catholic Church later found her a foster home, even if my mother's place, not as a true part of the family, but as a nanny to the foster parents' seven young children, was soon clear to her. And even if she would later drift away from the church to find divinity and grace in poetry and the grass and human beings, she learned that we are made for one another, that there are people in the world like nuns who dedicate their whole lives to achieving empathy and responsibility. There was also nature's instruction. Even in my mother's childhood, primarily in the form of the ocean, its enormity and its intimacy in the rock pools she told me about staring into for glimpses of small plants and creatures, the delicate and precious. But there's another answer, an eloquent, succinct, and beautiful reason my mother learned her own infinite worth and the essential responsibility of love. Nana. When Anya was born, my mother told me Nana was what she'd like Anya to call her if she wanted. And to this day, that is who my mother is to my daughter, Nana. But to my mother, Nana was the adult. Her mother's mother, who lived under the same doomed roof as her. She was the one who made sure my mother's school uniform was bright and clean, and her drawings got noticed, It was her Nana who tucked her in and read her books, who gave her universe a center of gravity other than the vortex. Like my mother's parents, her Nana died before I could know her. But I feel who she must have been. She flows through the memory of my mom when I lie beside Anya at night, inventing stories about Harry, Ron, and Hermione with happy endings so her dreams might be sweet. When I do Anya's laundry, when I spray stain remover on the butt of her play pants, stained from sliding down a mucky rock to get her closer look at a hermit crab or shrimp or anemone in the rock pool below her, I feel my mother's Nana. I feel depthless gratitude for this woman I never knew when I think of my mother's determination that I should feel secure and loved and capable. Like my mother's entire family, her Nana was of Scottish descent, so I feel her here when I look into the faces of old women in their proper dress and hair, stepping from their orderly cottages, all the homes they have made. But far more, I felt her in the way I held Anya's hand walking her to school. I felt her as I watched the ready, confident stride of Anya's step when she let go and headed off to meet her big day. 3 hours after we saw her at lunch, Anya emerged from school smiling to see us. And as we walked back through the village, she said she had made a friend. "Here's her number," she said, and handed Amy a piece of paper with big numbers in red marker. Amy, Anya, and I have this little ritual we perform before dinner. We hold hands around our table and tell one another what we're grateful for. If you were to look in the window of our cottage, you'd think we were saying a pre-dinner grace. And though there isn't anything overtly religious about it, I've no doubt our sense of reverence and gratitude and ritual comes to us, at least in part, from the Catholicism of my mother's childhood, and, as it happens, of Amy's childhood, too. Amy started. She said she was grateful for her husband and gave me a smile I read as thanks for enduring our first day of Anya in school here with her. "And I'm grateful for my girl." Anya said, "I'm grateful for school," with such spontaneity and enthusiasm that I knew she meant it, though I knew, too, that she knew it would please us to hear. I stole a glimpse at Amy's face and the pride and relief there. I began as I always do, superstitious as I am in my way, with gratitude for our health, and I continued for my family, and finally, for both Nanas and their influence on the people we've become and how we love one another. Pocket Journal Entry, Marquette, Day 2, February 3rd. I had hoped Mom would wake up and be ready, be able to go to the dialysis clinic after all, but she was extremely weak and groggy, only semi-conscious through her transfer from bed to wheelchair. There was, obviously, no way she was going to dialysis. This was disappointing not only because I'd hoped she would rally and go, but also because I realized that she was so weak, so tentative and frail without having missed any scheduled dialysis sessions yet. She was in no shape for surgery. And if she backed off the narcotics over the next few days, the pain would be horrid. Her hands are really a mess. And would weaken her further. A part of my brain screamed, "You idiot! Get her to dialysis now, and you'll be out in the backyard together come July. You gardening while she gives instructions." But what does she want? It's so hard to know. I say, "We can go to dialysis any time." I tell her she can decide to do what she wants, and she breathes faster and harder, and her face looks stressed. But stressed at the implications of what she's decided? Stressed by what she knows must be my worry? Stressed because of indecision? My sister Anne says she wants to stay with us. I say, "Of course she does." But, I'm thinking, what options does she have? Dad has told us her biggest concern was what the kids would think, my sister and I. She doesn't want us to agonize over complication after complication for the slim chance that for a short time she can go on. She doesn't want us to lose her. So it looks like this will happen. She will die at home. My mother, who has ridden through death-infested waters dozens, maybe hundreds of nights, she will die surrounded by family in her own bed. Scotland, late summer and early fall. The front wall of our cottage, the wall facing the sea and what I'm told will be freezing gales when winter comes, is 3 feet thick. The windows are set back a foot from the outside, leaving inside another 2 feet of sill, which forms a seat at each window. Anya has bunched a big, deep comforter into the window seat in her room, making it into a little bed. That's become the place she wants to be, with piles of pillows and tucked under her Harry Potter quilt, when I read to her and tell her a Harry, Ron, and Hermione story before proper bed each night. She can roll on her side, wipe the fog from one of the panes of glass, and look out at the harbor and the old stone seawall, the rows of white waves coming in, and the Isle of May lighthouse winking out on the dark horizon. The lighthouse is dark for 14 seconds between twin flashes. Anya has learned to time it just right so she gets an answer when she says, "Good night." Yesterday evening, walking up from the beach, I exchanged greetings with an elderly man who was rinsing off a sandy little girl in the spigot that protrudes from the rock wall beside the harbor. He nodded his tweed-capped head up at our cottage and asked if we were staying there. I told him we were, that we'd moved in for the year. He said it had been his grandparents' house. "They lived there for 60 years. I was struck silent, but it got better. "My brother and sister were both born there. My wife and I stayed the first month of our marriage in one of the rooms." I introduced myself and got his name, John Meldrum. "Same as my grandfather," he said. I invited him to come in for a look around. "No, no." He splashed water on the girl's feet. She must be the great-great-granddaughter of the couple who called the cottage home for 60 years, I realized. "Did your grandfather fish then?"
"Aye, kept a boat in the harbor. But that's old stories," he said. "My wife and I live in the south now and come up with my daughter's family on holiday."
According to the date etched above the door, the cottage was built in 1636. Today, I have a tough time thinking of it as ours. As I write in this bedroom, I can feel a kind of elsewhere all around me. It's the same harbor out there, the same stone seawall, same tides the boats follow out and back in. It's the same fireplace beside me. The coos of pigeons down the chimney sound the same as they must have for the elder John Meldrum's wife when she looked out for her husband's boat. These are the walls off which the newborn cries of the younger John Meldrum's brother and sister echoed. And the cries of how many others through the centuries, how many wives looked out this window to be sure their husband's boats were among those heading back in. The past is not truly present in any place. Even in places like Crail, where you can see exactly where someone decided one stone fit well on another 400 years ago. Like memory, the past has no substance. It's a kind of nothing, in fact. But, like memory, the past waits to take today into itself, and to carry today, too, through time, in the elsewhere that is, each new moment, all around us. The past will carry us off, too, one day. One day we will also be part of the nothing, the elsewhere in this place's new present moment. I confess I don't yet know how to make the most of that knowledge, how to use the awareness of our own mortality, how to use the fear, the terror that sometimes robs me of peace for days, that washes through me like icy water even now, that makes my hand tremble perceptibly as I write that my family and I are, like my mother was, like everyone, temporary. The truth is, I don't even know how to live with it, let alone use it. But this seems like the right place to figure that out. After riding the bus and walking everywhere for more than a month, we finally have a car. We've enjoyed the walking, but the old double-decker buses here sway absurdly as they careen down narrow village lanes and winding country roads. Riding those buses, even on the bottom deck, we've discovered that Anya has inherited Amy's propensity for motion sickness. Having a car means that every trip from Crail won't require a nausea endurance test for the two of them. And for me, a car means excursions into the mountains. I'm grateful to be living on the sea. I look up from my desk right now and see gray clouds over the Isle of May and rows of white waves pushing into the reefs, gulls tilting in the wind. But I haven't gotten over my Scottish dream of hikes into remote highland glens where the mountains rise green around me like living bodies. I still imagine that the highlands are where my muse must live, in some cottage on a slope, always in the next glen over, a low fire sending wisps of smoke from the chimney out over heath and pines. Anya's named the car Pigeon. It's a Volvo, good and safe for Amy and me to learn to drive on the left down narrow roads with cars, lorries, farm tractors, and those rocking double-decker buses coming seemingly straight at us. Though it's 10 years old, it's been so well kept that, as is typical of cars in the UK, it looks nearly new. Amy's charmed by the little headlight wipers. I like that the rear seat backs fold forward to form part of a flat plane all the way back into the trunk, a perfect bed for me when I slip away for a couple days in the mountains. I can picture the way the forest green paint will blend right in when I wake inside, parked on the side of some highland dirt road in the first light of dawn.
Thank you for listening to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. If you missed an episode, you can catch up online at spokanepublicradio.org or on the Bookshelf podcast. That marks the end of tonight's episode of The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. The music for this episode is by Kerdwin and Greg Spatz. I'm Ben Reed.